This is Dave Levine, and welcome to the second edition of Hearsay Culture, a show discussing the intersection of technology and society, and examining it from the perspective of everything other than the lawyer and everything other than the geek. And I explained last week what I meant by that, but just to refresh your memory, I am an attorney. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. So therefore, my discussions of these issues are going to naturally move towards the realm of law. Having said that, I do not want this show to be a discussion merely of the law. I do that all day, and I share that love with other attorneys, but nor do I want the show to be a discussion purely of technological issues. The result is we're threading a very fine needle here, and that fine needle boils down to trying to discuss issues in a way that kind of touches on those things, but really expands the horizons of people that don't interact with this stuff on a daily basis. Last week, I had the pleasure of interviewing Dave, who is a online professional poker player. This week, I have the pleasure of interviewing Jennifer Granick. The initial disclaimer that I should give, and Jennifer is aware of this, is that Jennifer is my boss. So perhaps now you're going to turn it off because you're going to think this is just going to be a discussion where I'm going to be trying to impress my boss and not really touch on tough issues. But hopefully I'll dispel that concern. Jennifer is the executive director of the Center for Internet and Society since January 2001. She's also a lecturer at Stanford Law School. By way of very brief background, she practiced criminal defense law after almost a decade before coming to Stanford, including stints at the Office of the State Public Defender and at criminal defense boutiques before founding her own law offices, the Law Offices of Jennifer Granick. Her background, or one of her major interests, is going to be the topic today, which is hackers. And Jennifer has a particular concern about the term hackers, which we'll discuss, but in a very general way, the topic today is going to be those kinds of cyber people that are out there working with computers, trying to figure out ways to use systems in unique ways, and sometimes, depending on the type of hacker, and we'll be talking about that, they could be doing it for nefarious purposes. The term hacker coming from Wikipedia, which for those of you, again, who are not focusing on technology on a daily basis, is kind of a public form of a dictionary, defines a hacker as a person, quote, able to exploit a system or gain unauthorized access through skill and tactics. There are different types of hackers, which we'll be discussing today, but the interesting thing that we'll be talking about is what it's like to defend a hacker when a hacker is charged with either criminal violations, violations of criminal law, or civil violations, violations of things that don't go towards something that could put you in jail. And Jennifer has extensive experience defending hackers, not only on a criminal level, but also thinking about these policies as the executive director at the Center for Internet and Society. I expect that it's going to be a very interesting discussion where we really explore Jennifer's background in this stuff, but also discussing what it means to be a hacker, what the law says about this stuff, how society perceives hackers, and the semantics, the nomenclature that we use to identify these people. So after a very brief musical interlude, we will come back. I will put Jennifer on the air, and hopefully we will have what will be a very interesting discussion. That was Laura Veer's Galaxies, a relatively new album. Before that, introducing the show, by the way, was the Flaming Lips, and Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, which in some way touches on the issues that we're going to discuss today. So
that's what we do all day over at the center.
There we go. There we go. And with that, Jennifer, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. So let's dive right in. I gave a very brief introduction of you, but I'm sure you could do a better job than me in kind of giving listeners a very brief background on what you've been doing as it relates to hackers.
Well, I got my start in this law business being a criminal defense attorney, and one type of criminal that I was really interested in was those that were accused of having committed computer crimes. So I got really interested in computers and computer security, and you know, all the related issues that go along with that, and I still still do a lot of work on behalf of hackers as part of my job at the Stanford Law School. You know, hacker law involves many more things than just crime. It involves certainly surveillance, but also trade secret law and free speech and rights of disclosure and all sorts of things like that, customer rights, privacy. So it's just a really rich area to practice in.
And what brought you initially into working in this area?
Well, geekdom really was the thing. I mean, it was, focusing on hackers was a way to combine my job, which was being a criminal defense attorney, with my, you know, my interest, which was a sort of geeky interest in computers. So, you know, you put those two things together and you've got a computer crime defense attorney.
And were you someone who kind of watched the criminal lawyer shows as a kid? And
no, I hated those.
Oh, really?
I hated those. But I did watch a lot of science fiction and, you know, of course, the usual sort of Star Trek, Star Wars, you know, kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
But the lawyer shows always were, you know, especially once you become a lawyer, they're harder and harder to watch because they're so inaccurate.
Yeah, I found it difficult.
At the TV, so I'm not allowed to watch them anymore.
You know, I'm the same way, and I guess that's one of the reasons why we're attorneys, because we'll even yell at inanimate objects if we think that we might get a point across.
I think there's a chance to win. I'll yell at it.
So let's talk initially about the term hacker, because I know it's something that it's a term that you kind of have an interesting opinion on. For the benefit of the listeners who, again, are not well-versed in this area, give us an idea of what it means to be a hacker and then what your concern is about the phrase as it's been used.
Right. So the word hacker used to mean somebody who was really knowledgeable about machines, or in particular computers, and understood how they worked and could make them work in new and interesting and alternative ways. Back in 1984, a Newsweek reporter, Stephen Levy, wrote a book which was called Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution. And this book was about these people, these hackers, who basically were the ones who took, you know, these really complicated, arcane machines and figured out how to make them do all sorts of stuff, like play games and how to write word processing programs on them and how to program them and how to make them, really expand what computers could, to build computers and expand what they could do for people. And what it's evolved to mean when people say hackers, they think that means criminal, somebody who's breaking into computers illegally and stealing information there. And you know, that'd be okay if the word changed meaning, except we've lost the word for the good guys. We've lost the word for the creative, innovative explorers of technology. So I like to use hackers in the, you know, original sort of sense, and pick a different word for the people who are criminals, like attackers or defendants or whatever, you know, whatever your word is going to be.
So hacker, it's interesting. So I always thought growing up of hackers as kind of those people sitting in dark rooms with tons of computers and wires, kind of like the character in the movie Pi.
Right.
Who's in the room.
Or War Games.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Or War Games, something even more familiar.
Maybe he's dating Halle Berry, like in Swordfish.
That's right. And you know, certainly the dating of Halle Berry would be something that may change the focus of what he's doing as a hacker.
Hacker wouldn't be distracted by something like that.
See, that's the interesting connotation, because I think the term hacker, to me, I always envisioned kind of the person that was really completely dedicated to computers themselves. But it's a broader, the broader idea of what a hacker, quote unquote, is doing is not just focusing on breaking into a computer system so that they can do something nefarious. It has a
right.
much broader application.
It even has a sense outside of the computer realm, where the hacker is somebody who looks at how things are supposed to work and can make them work in new and innovative or alternative ways, you know,
mm-hmm.
like a life hacker or somebody who's able to hack the system. You know, then the word in that sense means somebody who's able to take obstacles and overcome them, not necessarily in a bad way, maybe in a really, really great way.
So that's where I assume the phrase white hat, black hat, gray hat comes from in terms of hackers, or am I?
Yes, no, that's
it?
Right. It's another way of trying to distinguish between, the word, what hacker used to mean and what hackers kind of come to mean among popular you know, sort of popular usage today, mm-hmm. where the black hat hacker's the bad guy, and the white hat hacker's the good guy, and the gray hat's for all those people who don't want to take sides yet, sort of the agnostics waiting to see where they should, what team they should play for.
So there's a real social element to it as well, in terms of what the purpose is for going in there, and then how you decide to define yourself as someone working with these computers.
Definitely. I mean, a lot of hacking and a lot of hacking computers in the way that hackers consider themselves different from just programmers or, you know, engineers or something like that, is that there is this element of not taking the rules as a given. There's this element to it of being alternative or not being constrained by what you're told the boundaries of things are. Mm-hmm. And people who consider themselves to be hackers are in that world. So they may also have very alternative political viewpoints or alternative sexual or social practices or other sorts of alternative lifestyles. They may use their hacking skills in lots of other ways so that they don't have a 9-to-5 job, or they don't have a normal car. They have a car that's made from like 5 other cars, or, you know, something like that. So it's, you know, if I tell you, look, you know, there's no way to get in there, a hacker never thinks that's true, right? If I tell you, oh, I'm sorry, sir, but you can't do this, it can't be done, a hacker never thinks that's true. And that's great, because that impulse is often the source of real innovation.
Right, is it to push the boundaries of what people expect.
Exactly.
Right.
Push the boundaries of what people expect, and also what you're told is possible with what's available.
Right. Now, not to focus solely on kind of a William Sapphire word maven focus here, but I want to make sure that I have some of the terms down correctly. So you mentioned this notion that the hacker isn't necessarily someone who's a criminal. Now, I understand also there are phrases like crackers and freakers.
Right.
Can you give me an idea? I mean, all of these different odd words that are so idiosyncratic to technology, can you give me an idea what those people would be?
Yeah, well, a cracker could be the criminal, could be the attacker, somebody who cracks into something. But I've met a lot of crackers who think of themselves as not criminals at all. They say, well, cracker is somebody who can break encryption. They can figure out whether your passwords are secure. They can break encryption on various things. So a cracker isn't necessarily doing something illegal either. A cracker is just somebody who knows how encryption can break and who studies how encryption can break. So you still need the word attacker or criminal to address the people who are breaking the law. Freaker is specifically a term about people who know how to manipulate the phone network.
Okay.
And it's spelled PH, like with the phone. And freaker is somebody who's able to get free phone calls or free voicemail or, you know, get access on phone systems or that sort of thing. So it's specifically about knowledge about the phone system.
I think we could probably go at least an hour just trying to figure out all the terms. But I think with that general background, let's kind of turn to some of your own experiences. So again, as you mentioned and as I mentioned, your background is defending individuals, whether they be hackers, crackers, freakers, or somewhere in the middle.
Right. By the time they get to me, mostly they are accused criminals.
Okay.
Right? So I do represent people in the civil context where there's just a question of whether they did something wrong, but they're not a criminal. But I represent them when they're charged with crimes as well.
And what kind of crimes do prosecutors generally charge these individuals with? What kind of umbrella do they fall under?
Well, there's breaking and entering types of crimes where, you know, you got into a computer system you weren't supposed to get into. And then there's listening to people's conversations or grabbing their email you're not supposed to do. So there's those kinds of eavesdropping types of crimes. And then there's stealing information that you're not supposed to have access to, like getting somebody's password file or getting access to files you weren't supposed to have. So there's those sorts of crimes. So there's, you know, a whole range of possible things. There's also intellectual property crimes, like you copied something you weren't supposed to copy, and that's a violation of the copyright law, or you trade secret, you found out something in an improper way that is proprietary information for a company.
Mm-hmm. Do you find dealing with prosecutors, let's focus on the criminal side first. So when you're dealing with a prosecutor who's obviously decided that your client should be charged with something, Do you find that there's, again, I mean, I'm kind of getting back to this whole preconceived notion idea of what people are doing. The prosecutor obviously is alleging a crime, so they're obviously thinking that the law has been broken. But do they draw these kinds of differences between what the purpose was for getting into the system or for why, the moral reasons perhaps?
They totally look at the moral reasons. They mm-hmm. totally do. And the reason is that the law itself, as it describes the crime, is really broad. Arguably, anytime you use a computer in a way that the owner doesn't want you to, you're arguably breaking the law, either the federal law or the state law. Well, that's really big because people use computers in strange ways all the time. I mean, my boss may not want me to use my computer at work to check to see whether there's ball game tickets available, but I do that. Is that a crime? So there's lots of things that normal people do, but they don't get charged, and that's because prosecutors take a look and decide whether they think that what this was bad or good. Mm-hmm. Now, some people may feel like, good, you know, we're glad we have prosecutors there, and I think it's good. We're glad we have prosecutors there to exercise discretion. But the problem is when the types of things that are illegal are so numerous and so broad, and you're just depending on the prosecutor to make the distinction, and you get the real risk that the prosecutor's going to choose stuff based on what kind of person the prosecutor likes or feels comfortable with and what kind of person the prosecutor thinks is kind of off. And I had a case like this about a year and a half ago, which was my United States versus Brett McDaniel case, and I could tell a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. Basically, this was a case where Brett sent information by email to the customers of his former employer, which ran this web message service. And then he said, hey, this web message service is insecure. People could read your messages and find out your account information, including your credit card number. You should take steps to protect yourself. And the prosecutor, the United States government, charged him with a crime for that. Now, you know, I think many of our listeners don't have to be lawyers to know that the First Amendment says you can speak and say truthful things and you can't get in trouble for that. But nonetheless, the prosecutor prosecuted him and the judge convicted him. And one of the pieces of evidence in the case that they used was they didn't like that he was wearing a hacker conference T-shirt at the time that he was arrested. They said, look, he's wearing a T-shirt from DEF CON, a hacker conference, and that T-shirt shows you what kind of person he is. He's a hacker, and he's got bad intent. On appeal, the government admitted that the whole conviction was wrong, and they moved to dismiss it and get rid of the conviction. But one of the discretionary parts of this was that they just didn't like the way that Brett handled things.
So it was a situation where people are entering a court with preconceived notions about what's going on, including things that otherwise, in many other contexts, wouldn't matter, like your style of dress, because these are people that are kind of viewed as outliers in society.
Right. Yeah. They're definitely, you know, why is he at a hacker conference? And yeah. That was interesting to me because I go to that DEF CON conference as well, and I have that T-shirt. I was seriously debating whether to wear my T-shirt to the oral argument before the Ninth Circuit or not. And luckily, I didn't have to actually confront that decision because the prosecution gave up before I had a chance to have my oral argument. But I was going to kind of rip off my suit jacket and be like, see, I'm not a criminal and I got the shirt.
And do you find, because I know that that's one of several examples, and I do want to discuss with you shortly some of, you know, the experiences of a few of the cases you had, but how typical is that reaction when you're generally dealing with defending hackers? Do you find that most people, now I'm saying broader than just prosecutors, but just generally, are most people kind of thinking that you're defending, again, these underworld characters that are out to destroy, or do you find that there's a more nuanced understanding of the technology and what these people are about?
I think a lot of people, and I'll say sort of normal people, when they hear the word hacker or, you know, computer system, they think that it's a criminal person. I think that people don't realize how easy it is and how normal it is to use computers in ways that the owner might not have agreed to. Search engines do it. Shopping bots do it. Sending an email somebody doesn't want does it. So there's just all sorts of things that I think people don't think about. When they hear hacker, they think, oh, he broke in. And people don't like the idea of breaking in. Mm-hmm. And they think that breaking in means the same thing as like somebody breaking into your house. They'll right. often use that analogy. It was like somebody comes into your house. Of course, nobody can go into a computer and nobody lives there, so there's some obvious differences. But I think among the kind of common parlance, people think of hackers as being criminals. But when people hear more about the facts of cases and you know, think a little bit more about the way that they themselves use computers, then I think that they realize that that's just a kind of rhetorical reaction. It's not really about what's going on.
Is it in terms of the crimes that you've defended, just to get, I kind of want to get the broad range, but what would you describe as the most outrageous crime that your clients have been charged with? And I'm focusing on the criminal side now. I do want to talk about the civil after the next music break, but give us an idea of the range there.
Sort of the most brazen thing
yes.
that one of my clients ever did.
Exactly.
Well, I did represent somebody who was charged with breaking into over 450 government computers. And basically through a known flaw in software, but then patching that flaw, but leaving a back door for himself to get in. So,
and a back door just means basically that it's a secret way for an individual to circumvent the security and access the system?
Right. Just a way that he could go back into these systems without the flaw still being there. So basically the allegation was, you know, these computer systems were open to anyone in the public who knew about what the flaw was. And he fixed the problem, but he left himself a way to still get back in.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, Air Force and National Laboratory and a lot of computers.
This is these kinds of crimes, again, I think, because of the nature of the behavior, because we're dealing with technology and these very, you know, very kind of narrowly defined crimes that focus on an individual going after a computer system and using these very technological terms. Do you find that the courts increasingly are understanding these terms? I mean, we spent the first 10 minutes of the show just defining some of the basic ideas. How do you find that the courts generally are reacting to these crimes today as people are more familiar and more comfortable with technology?
Well, I think courts are doing better, and I think that the investigators, the FBI and prosecutors, are doing better, but the McDaniel case shows that they're not good enough. Perhaps it shows that a little bit of knowledge can be a really dangerous thing. So we still need to have a lot of education out there to really understand what is going on. But I think that the main thing is, because you have juries too, and juries need to understand what somebody's being accused of having done as well. And how do you kind of bring all these people up to speed and educate them? I think one of the most important things to think about is whether computers are really all that different from the real world and whether we want to be prosecuting different kinds of things than we prosecute in the real world. Because juries understand stealing. Juries understand damaging something. One of the reasons why we have all this uncertainty in computer crimes is because computer crimes aren't necessarily about destroying something or stealing anything. They're just about gaining access. And that term is really kind of fuzzy and strange when you're thinking about it in a virtual context as opposed to in the real world, sort of somebody's in your house context.
Let's take a brief break, and then when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of those cases and some of the information that people have been able to access by way of these activities and what your experience has been. So
great.
We will take a short break. That's Lita Husek, who's actually a musician out of New York. She's had a number of independent albums that have, I think, gone under the radar, but that's a topic for a music show. That song is the song Dead Poets. So we're back with Jennifer. And before the break, I was asking about some of the cases. Let's talk about one case for which I am personally familiar, which is the case involving Michael Lynn. I, as I mentioned, listeners last week, but I've written an article dealing with trade secret law and the technological aspects in public infrastructure. Michael Lynn, who I know is an individual you defended, was charged with a very interesting crimes, or several civil charges, I should say. Why don't you talk a little bit about the case, a brief background, and I'll ask you some questions about the nuances in that case.
Sure. So this guy was working for a company, and his job was to look at Cisco routers. And these Cisco routers are made by Cisco, and they're basically kind of the internet backbone. They're these specialized computers that move information along on the internet. And as part of his job, he found that there was a pretty serious problem with these Cisco routers that would let an attacker take them over and run other programs on them that the owner didn't want. It's pretty serious. So there was some back and forth between his company and Cisco, but basically Cisco didn't want him to announce this problem, which was kind of strange since Cisco had already fixed the problem. It was just that older versions were still broken and you had to upgrade, but customers didn't really know you had to upgrade. And Mike thought that customers should know that they need to upgrade if they don't want their routers to be owned by, you know, some attacker.
Mm-hmm. And so that's
a little hacker term, owned, which is when some outsider takes over your machine and has complete control over it.
Mm-hmm.
So, at a conference in Las Vegas, the Black Hat conference, where computer security experts talk to other computer security experts about their research, Mike revealed that he had discovered this problem in the Cisco routers. He didn't explain to people how they could take advantage of it, but he did demonstrate that he had the ability to take advantage of it, to prove that what he was saying was in fact true. And following that presentation, Cisco and Mike's employer sued him civilly. And they sued him for things that are also crimes. A lot of crimes can also be things that a private party files a lawsuit against you for, as opposed to the government going after you. And they claimed that he had violated their trade secrets by revealing this information.
And the trade secret is generally something that has commercial value for a company when kept secret in various circumstances.
Right. It's, you know, the classic example is the formula for Coke. You mm-hmm. know, it's something that the company takes great pains to keep from the public, and as a result, it gives it some kind of commercial advantage. I don't think that at the time we fashioned the trade secret law, we thought that it should be a valuable trade secret that your product's broken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's and that kind of touches on what I wanted to focus on. So on your blog, which, by the way, is granik.com, correct?
Right.
You wrote extensively about your experience actually physically being at the conference where Mr. Lin was going to present this.
Right.
Again, being on the scene as an attorney is something which is kind of unusual. I mean, it's not often the case that the attorney is actually physically present in the location where the alleged law violations occurred.
Right.
What was that like for you?
Well, it was pretty intense. I mean, I didn't actually see him give the presentation. I knew he was going to give the presentation, and I knew that there were legal issues involved because Cisco had come in with an army of lawyers and interns the evening before and cut all of Mike's presentation out of the Black Hat books. So they had come to an agreement with the conference that Mike wouldn't give this presentation. Mike just, once he got on the stage, gave the presentation anyway. So I had heard night before, you know, we've got this team of lawyers here. This is going to be a big deal. But I flew in the next morning right after Mike had given his speech, and I saw him standing there in the hall, and he had a white hat on, and it said good on it. You know, one of these white baseball caps that said good. And I talked to him a little bit about it, and he, by that afternoon, he had gotten served with the papers. So that was pretty frenetic, you know. And at that point, we didn't know whether a follow-up to that was going to be that they would be able to interest the Department of Justice in it and the FBI would come by and try to arrest him or what. We were pretty nervous. And sure enough, the next day, some FBI agents showed up. And I can tell you that the FBI agents stuck out like sore thumbs at the hacker conference. My parents live in Las Vegas, so I was actually in the forum shops at Caesars having a giant three-person Mai Tai with my mother and my sister when my cell phone rang and I was told that there were two FBI agents looking for me on the conference floor back at the hotel.
And you didn't think it was the alcohol at that point?
No, no, although, you know, when you're in my business, you get used to the FBI calling. I remember the first time the Secret Service ever called me and I was, and then I realized, oh, wait, that's my job. So, you know, I don't have to be that nervous. But I, you know, left my Mai Tai and I went back to the hotel to see what was up. And there were, sure enough, FBI agents, you know, poking around wanting to ask questions. A lot of fuss for something which, you know, as has been revealed, and there haven't been any negative consequences to it. It was almost a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that being, as an attorney, being immersed in that field, because you were there to attend the conference and also to participate in it, correct?
Right. I was speaking at the conference.
Right.
Although I do consider one of my roles there to be, you know, the doling out of free, you know, legal assistants.
Right. Yeah, that's where I'm going. How do you straddle those worlds? Because obviously it's good to be there professionally to keep current with what's happening in the field, especially, you know, with individuals, you know, whom you have that relationship. But what's it like to kind of be the person who's not only immersed in the technology, but also potentially the person that someone there can turn to say, oh my God, the FBI's contacted me. I'm being accused of various law violations by this company. What do I do?
Yeah, well, I mean, this will probably accord with some of your listeners' views of lawyers anyway, but one of the reasons I started going to these hacker conferences in the beginning was to get clients, so there's nothing new there. I mean, I learn a lot from being there, and I think that people learn a lot from me when I give my presentations there, but I initially went because I wanted clients. Now, I don't really need clients. I work at the law school, and I'm up to my neck in clients, but I still have this idea that I'm there to help people and to protect them and to, you know, encourage the good stuff they do. And, you know, so I still view myself as an important member of the hacker society. You know, I think of myself as, well, I'm the lawyer.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it benefits the clients as well that you don't have to be explained what a hacker is and what gray hat means and all that.
Well, the thing that helps them the most is that I'm sucker enough to do it pro bono, right? So, you know, when Mike got in trouble, he didn't have money to hire a lawyer and defend himself or negotiate any agreements or anything like that.
Right.
But I just did it because I was there and because I could and because I cared, and that's my role. If I'm not going to do that, then why am I even there?
How do you see companies that operate computers and governments that operate computers, obviously, reacting to the presence of these people who have this capability? So taking the Lin situation as an example, you know, he was able to at least publicize a potential security issue involving the computer. And notwithstanding the fact that the company, in fact, had corrected the problem, and the problem really wasn't a present one that someone could seize on and compromise these Cisco routers. What does it mean today for you as an attorney and for the hackers in general? And I keep using this term, even though I know that I'm using it for convenience purposes, but these people that, as opposed to attackers.
Right.
How do you see society reacting to this stuff, and what does it mean for us?
Well, I think society's been doing a lot better job about understanding the role that hackers play in helping keep computer networks secure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of the idea is, if I don't know about it, it can't hurt me. The ostrich head in the sand kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And with computers, that's particularly not true, because it's just so cheap and easy for an attacker to just keep trying and trying until he gets it right. So you'd rather have a good guy find out first.
Mm-hmm.
And several years ago, there was a real animosity, I think, between software companies and system owners and the hackers who were testing those systems and finding out whether there were vulnerabilities, holes that an attacker could get through. But I think it's really evolved to be better. It's not perfect, but it's better. Software companies recognize that hackers are providing a valuable service. They're quality testing the software once it leaves the factory. And hackers are better about thinking that software companies are going to be responsive to their demands, because the software companies know that if they don't fix the product, the hacker's going to tell people and customers are going to be upset that their privacy was compromised by this. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people don't like the way that this kind of disclosure process works, but it has evolved to a place where it works a lot better than it used to.
That evolution is something that's also very interesting. As you have evolved in your career dealing with this stuff, I would imagine that initially when you were defending these people who came to you, it was in situations for which there was very little or no legal precedent. In other words, you had a situation where you may be creating the law, you may be the test case that either a government or a company is using to determine how to work with these people. You mentioned the level of sophistication, which is generally increasing throughout, you know, in all aspects of defending these cases. But where do you see us going 5 years from now, as more and more people are using the internet for everything, as you know, as people are banking more and more, and really it's no longer something which only the government deals with or only a big company deals with, but every individual does. How do you see people reacting to that? Are hackers and this activity going to be viewed as more nefarious because more people are involved, or perhaps it'll go the other way, so that people will say, well, these people are providing a valuable service that the companies and governments aren't themselves picking up?
Yeah, there's sort of two pressures in opposite directions. One is that as more people do more important stuff online, privacy becomes more important. And so and e-commerce is really important and all of that. So the feeling that attackers are out there or people are meddling where they don't belong seems more dangerous, right? On the other hand, because we have all this information about ourselves that's out there, security is more important than ever before. And it's the hackers that do all the quality testing after the fact. You know, a software company does testing on its software before it ships it out in the box, but it just can't do the kind of in-depth testing to make sure that the software is perfect. In fact, software may never be perfect. So we have people who do that afterwards and tell the company, and then the company can fix it and make it better. I think everybody knows one of the ways you get better is you get some constructive criticism and you learn from it and you improve. So on the one hand, I think people have more reason to fear hackers. On the other hand, I think people clearly have more reason to rely on hackers to help with security.
Mm-hmm. When you're let's turn to the end game. Obviously, you've had a lot of success in defending these individuals and getting results for them that you felt were good for your clients and what have you. But have you had experience on the criminal side with sentencing and that kind of stuff?
Yes, definitely. I mean, when you're a defense attorney, you're not supposed to win that much. So I have definitely handled a couple of sentencings.
And tell us a little bit about that process. I mean, how does that work out for these people who are, especially we can focus two directions. So the first direction would be your own personal experiences. But then the second would be in this climate that we have of national security being important and of people viewing national security issues as often taking precedence over everything, including privacy and free speech and what have you. Where do you see sentencing going?
Right. Well, on the one hand, with sentencing, it's like people are kind of reacting to what's more sensational as opposed to what's more dangerous. So I had this one case where the person was accused of hacking the eBay website and then also getting unauthorized access and having secret accounts on all these other machines. Well, having secret accounts on the other machines is pretty serious because you can install software on them and do whatever you want, basically. Hacking the eBay webpage is no big deal. It goes down and eBay just posts it back up. It's a pretty easy thing to fix. But in terms of sentencing, it's the reverse because eBay says, well, we have to hire all these consultants and we have to be really concerned and it was e-commerce, we lost sales. And they can say that all of these economic harms happened as a result. Whereas just having an unauthorized account on the machine, it may totally compromise somebody's privacy, but it's hard to put a financial number on that. And a lot of computer crime sentencing, most of it, is based on putting a financial number on something.
Mm-hmm.
The thing with national security that's so interesting is that if you look at the hacker cases that the Department of Justice has brought recently, none of them have to do with national security.
That's very interesting.
It is. I mean, the most recent one that I know that they brought is a guy who got access to some student records on the University of Southern California website. Just a very, in the scheme of things, not that big a deal. So we talk about the computer crime laws as being really important for protecting national security, but they're not really part of national security. We're not using them for that purpose at all. We're still dealing with these kind of lower level petty sort of things.
That's a surprising fact, considering especially what's been happening in the last week or two with the revelation that phone companies were giving over phone records to the NSA. What do you see? What are some of the underlying reasons you think for this odd or perhaps counterintuitive focus?
Well, one thing I think is that there's no such thing as cyber terrorism. I mean, it exists in theory, but in practice, real terrorism works so much better. So I think that that's what terrorists are focusing on. They're not focusing on, computers or knocking out computers. And I think that justifiably the government's resources needs to be on preventing stuff that can actually hurt people as opposed to things that can take down computers. We think a lot about what could happen. I think that's important. But in terms of practically what we're going to focus on, we should be focusing on other stuff. Why some of these little dinky cases kind of slip through and end up getting charged, though, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And what about companies? Do you find that they also are taking this kind of position? I would imagine, again, using the Lin situation as the crucible for this analysis, you have companies who clearly are seeing that to the extent that someone breaking into their computer system or revealing information about their system would affect their bottom line, affect dollars. But do you find that these companies, or do you think that these companies are taking a broader view of it in terms of trying to shut down this activity now before more and more people are capable or interested in behaving the same way?
Well, I think companies use it to get commercial advantage, totally apart from, you know, their legitimate bottom line, just to stop people from competing with them. That's what we've seen. For example, I had a case where American Airlines used the computer crime law to stop a company from searching their site for internet-only web fares because they were afraid that it would be, you know, competitive. There's been lawsuits where companies have stopped people from finding cruise ship prices or, you know, cruise prices because they don't want the competitor to be able to figure out competitive pricing. There's been cases about search engines. There's been cases about subpoenas, you know, all sorts of cases where civil litigants have been able to use the computer crime laws to gain all kinds of commercial advantage and to stop people from accessing otherwise public, otherwise non-proprietary information they publish on their websites. But, you know, what do you expect? Companies are going to do whatever they can to gain an upper hand in litigation.
Mm-hmm. If you were to, in the remaining few minutes that we have left, if you were to identify one major problem in the law, what would it be and what would your solution be right now? It sounds to me like it's been interesting for me to hear that there's actually a greater understanding of these issues than I thought was evident from what I've read. But what do you
see? Well, maybe I'm a huge optimist. I don't know.
Well, optimism or not, I think, what you seem to be talking about is the idea that people are not taking this black and white, you know, this all or nothing view of what it means to behave this way. The War Games idea from the movie, I mean, is kind of, I think, for a lot of people, the notion of the hacker. The idea of Matthew Broderick, again, in his room with all of this equipment that all but, you know, 0.0001% of the world knows, you know, would not know what to do with, and he's there breaking into the missile defense system for the United States.
Right.
Obviously, it's a simplified movie idea, but we seem to have moved much further away from that. So, you know, optimism or not, where do you
see...
We're
more like the daughter in Jurassic Park hacking into the network there to save everybody from the dinosaurs.
Right, right. And exactly. And it sounds to me like this notion of saving the world, of fixing problems, often underlies this behavior. And I guess you're finding that people are recognizing that at least a little bit more, as opposed to just ignoring it and saying that's just an alibi or an excuse for what is criminal behavior.
Well, I'm a real optimist, and I have a lot of faith in juries and in the American judicial system. So in some ways, I have to believe that. And if I thought that people were wallowing about in willful and uncorrectable ignorance, I just wouldn't be able to get up out of bed every day.
Right.
So I don't know if what I'm saying is empirically true, but I do think that the American people are inherently sensible. And I think that when they hear that, you mean I'm not allowed to find out what the price of a cruise is and tell my neighbor, or I'm not allowed to use this shopping tool because, you know, or you mean we're prosecuting somebody because he told us that something was broken and it was. I just think that the American people have a nose for that kind of, that's not the way that we want to conduct our legal business.
Mm-hmm. I would be remiss not only because I'm employed by CIS, but also again because I'm talking to my boss here on Hearsay Culture to ask you what is the Center for Internet Society doing, and what do you have any plans in the future for dealing specifically with these kinds of computer crimes? I mean, I know of a few situations that we've been dealing with, but maybe you could give the listeners a sense, because I tried to do that in the first show, about what CIS does to focus in this area of computer crimes and defending attackers, hackers, whatever.
Right. So, well, this is a academic program at Stanford Law School, and we deal with the intersection of civil liberties and public interest and how those are affected by changes in technology, most specifically computer technology, but changes in technology. So, you know, this is about free speech on the internet. It's about how digital information transfer changes our notions of privacy. So it's about all sorts of really great and interesting issues like that. Specifically, we do a lot of stuff. We do a lot of free speech, intellectual property cases. We do some anonymity cases. We do privacy stuff. We do cases against spyware and that kind of thing. So we have a lot of you know, a lot of things that are within our, a lot of eggs that fit into our basket. But with specifically with regards to the hacker thing, we have really been focused on the free speech rights of the hacker and the rights of consumers to know the truth about whether the computer systems they use are secure or not. And so really looking at defending people and protecting them when they are delivering truthful information in a responsible way to the American people.
It sounds to me like, I think one of the limitations of having an hour-long show is that what you've just said would open up at least another half hour of discussion. Alas, though...
You'll have to have me back.
And that was going to be my request. And so I look forward to having you back here to continue the discussion because I think that this, obviously, this issue isn't going away.
You're just saying you want me back because I'm your boss.
Well, you know, that could be part of it. That could be part of it. Of course, if there was a camera here actually seeing my physical appearance, then one could judge it. I suspect that if I attempt to explain that's not the case, it's just going to sound like nothing more than what it is, an explanation. So I will invite you back. So I guess I'll caveat by saying so long as I remain employed here. That way, I don't have to tie it to anything directly. But in all seriousness, thank you for coming today. This has been a great discussion. I do look forward to having you come back to talk about some of the privacy First Amendment issues that CIS is involved with that I've been working on while I've been here.
Can I give my email address?
That's what I was going to say. I would also be remiss if I didn't give you the opportunity to identify how you could be contacted and any plugs that you wanted to make.
Well, I just, for your listeners, if they're interested in these topics or if they'd like to hear other shows on this or if they need more information about these kinds of issues, they can email me at jennifer@law.stanford.edu or go to our Center for Internet and Society website, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or as you said, my website, which is granick.com. But I'd be interested in any emails from listeners on topics that they enjoyed hearing about.
And I think I would say the same generally about the show. As I mentioned last week or 2 weeks ago, I can be reached through the CIS website as well. And I think these kinds of topics are the kinds of topics that I think need to be discussed more, again, in a context that isn't purely law or purely technology. So, Jennifer, thank you so much for coming today.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. And we're just going to take a brief musical break and then come back. That is the Throwing Muses and the song Teller. Jennifer was really an interesting guest. It opens up a lot of other topics that we're going to be discussing in coming shows. Next week, I will have the pleasure of interviewing yet another person affiliated with CIS as I do my run through everyone that I can possibly talk to who would be interested in coming on the air, but they're all such great people. Next week is going to be non-resident fellow Colette Vogel, who will be discussing podcasting, which is kind of the analogous way to communicate publicly along the side of radio. Colette has recently authored, along with a couple of other people, a legal guide to podcasting, and so we're going to be talking about what it means to podcast and what exactly is going on in that very interesting area. So my name is Dave Levine. This is the show Hearsay Culture. Coming up in a few minutes is going to be Brownie in Motion, getting back to a music format fully as opposed to the musical interludes that I've been throwing in occasionally. So thank you again for listening. The show is going to be on every Wednesday from 5 to 6 Pacific Standard Time for those of you who are listening to this on the Internet. Thanks for listening. I do hope to hear from any and all of you with any comments or suggestions about the show, not only about this show, but future guests and things that we could talk about. Thank you for listening, and have a good evening.